Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to episode 4 of the Sober Butterfly Podcast. I'm your host, Nidhi Movina, and this week's episode, we are talking all about harm reduction. What is harm reduction? Many people have not heard this term before, and for those who think they know what harm reduction is, maybe this week's episode will change your perspective because there's a lot of stigma that exists in the recovery spaces around what harm reduction is. So before we jump into this week's episode, I just want to share a brief overview of what harm reduction entails. Harm reduction is an approach that emphasizes engaging directly with people who use drugs to prevent overdose and infectious disease transmission, improve the physical, mental, and social well-being of those served, and offer low-threshold options for accessing substance use disorder treatment and other health care services. I sat down with an expert in harm reduction. Dr. Dolores Blackwell is a multi-jurisdictional licensed clinical social worker, a master addiction counselor, a certified trauma professional, and a certified compassion fatigue professional. She has held numerous administrative and clinical positions within both the addictions and mental health disciplines. She currently serves as the director of OASIS at Housing Works. She's also an adjunct professor at Toro College and at Hunter College Silberman School of Social Work, where she teaches advanced clinical courses and the practice lab. She has a wealth of knowledge, and I learned so much from this interview, so I really hope that you will take away as much as I did from listening to her wisdom. One quick disclaimer before we get started. It's not really a disclaimer, I'm being extra. It's an FYI. I was sick as a dog when I recorded this interview with Dr. Dolores Blackwell. I look cute. I went the extra mile and made sure I put makeup on and stuff, but in reality, I was sick. So you may remember, like, I had COVID maybe like a month or so ago, and since recovering from COVID, I've been roaming these New York City streets without wearing a mask. Like, I thought that I was immune to everything. Clearly that is not the case. I caught a cold. You guys be safe out there. Make sure you're wearing your mask because, yeah, you can get sick. I may sound like I'm chain smoking a pack of Newports during this interview, but I promise I'm not. So yeah, just to give you a little heads up, my voice is shaky and I'm still a little bit like sick still. Anyway, just FYI. Thanks. Enjoy the episode and wear your mask. I am joined today with a very special guest by the name of Dr. Dolores Blackwell. Welcome, Dr. Dolores Blackwell, to the Sober Butterfly Podcast. We are so honored to have you on today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so very much for asking me, and I am looking forward to it.
I think the audience will really appreciate today's episode because we are learning so much about harm reduction, what that entails, the population it serves, and how it can really help someone who is struggling through addiction. Dr. Blackwell, can you just explain to me a little bit about your role with the Housing Works office and all of the wonderful support that you offer through the OASIS division of the Housing Works program?
Well, I'm currently the director of OASIS services at Housing Works, and we have two locations, one located in Park Avenue in East Harlem, and we have another located in East New York, Brooklyn, New York.
From your experience, what demographic of people are typically coming into the offices? What does that look like in terms of their gender, in terms of their race, in terms of their age? Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering what that spectrum looks like as a holistic picture.
Interestingly enough, it generally tends to be 80 to 85% male, African-American, and about the ages of, I'd say, 25 to 45. Wow. And that's what we generally tend to see. There are some programs out there that focus specifically on women. And so okay. I think part of this challenge or part of this is really being thoughtful about what type of program you would like to come into, because that's one of the challenges for folks to come in for treatment in the first place, finding a program that is a goodness of fit. I'd like to explain the whole concept of harm reduction if I can.
Please. Oh, that was my next question. So okay. By all means. Yeah.
Okay. So when we think about harm reduction, I'd like for your audience to think about, well, what is harm reduction? The first example I love is, how many people use seatbelts?
Me. I'm raising my hand.
And probably everyone uses seatbelts, right?
Yes.
How many people have that infamous New Year's resolution where they decide, I am going to, and you can fill in the blanks, I'm going to cut down on sugar, I am going to exercise more, etc.
Quit smoking cigarettes.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Those are all harm reduction based, because wow. You're looking to change a current behavior and to reduce the level of impact it has on your life. So when we talk about harm reduction, we have to look at a spectrum. The spectrum of behavior is one, abstinence-based, I want to stop this, okay? Then two, we have, I want to reduce this. So I want to reduce the impact that this is having on my life. And the last is safer. I want to do this in a safer way. So when we apply that to substance use or alcohol use, we have folks who may want to stop using completely, okay? And we support that. We also support folks who want to reduce use, such as reducing the amount of alcohol that they're intaking, whether it's on a daily basis, a weekly basis, et cetera. And we also have folks who will want to engage in safer use. So for example, someone is engaging in heroin use, et cetera, safer needles, needle exchanges, et cetera. The thing about harm reduction is we make no judgment for around anyone wanting to stop use, reduce use, use safer, et cetera. And that's a little bit different than abstinence. And so we want to make sure that folks understand what the whole spectrum of harm reduction looks like and the importance that it meets people where they are. Because not everyone is ready to stop using, but some may be ready to reduce use or use safer.
Wow, that's prolific. I really like the example that you provided in the sense of the New Year's resolution, right? Because I think most people have these great intentions when they set these goals, but sometimes if they're too extreme, right? And we're not seeing the progress that we'd like, sometimes we feel disheartened. And it's like, for example, if I say I'm going to quit smoking and I'm an avid smoker, that overnight turn is not necessarily realistic. And so then I feel like I'm a failure. And then the goal just goes out the window. So sometimes you feel overwhelmed if your goal is set too high. So I understand that model. And I really appreciate you bringing that into perspective for us.
Harm reduction is not just about safer injection sites. And I think that particularly in the city and in particular spaces and in particular moderators like to use harm reduction and weaponize harm reduction in that way. Harm reduction is any behavior that reduces harm. So it's seatbelts, it's diets, it's the whole gamut. And I think that that's important for folks to know.
Would methadone clinics be considered harm reduction as well?
Yes.
I think those are the two things I hear. Like people will reference methadone clinics and then the syringe exchange programs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those are actually harm reduction strategies as well on the safer use spectrum.
From your findings, do you feel people that are undergoing this harm reduction, does it lead to abstinence at any point?
Yes.
That does happen.
I mean, initially, so folks can come in with one goal, but later on, as they continue to receive treatment, individual work or group work, they may change their goal. So someone may initially come in saying, hey, I want to reduce my use, and then think about, you know what, I think I want to stop. We also have individuals who use multiple substances who may decide, okay, I'm not ready to stop using marijuana, but I definitely want to reduce drinking or I want to stop drinking. And so we look at all of that and really meet the person where they are, regardless as to what their substances that they're engaged in. We also have to look at the impact of the social determinants of health. So we have to look at the thought around discrimination, stigma. We have to think about health equity. We have to think about access to care. We have to think about family, all of those different components and how they play a role in either helping folks to stop substances, if that's what they choose to do, or maybe sustaining those substances. So thinking about someone who has had significant trauma in their lives and thinking about, I'm in pain. And I don't want to feel this pain. So I may drink a little more. I may use substances that I may not have used in the past, et cetera, because I don't want to feel this pain. One of the things that I find amazing about human beings is we will do amazing things to avoid pain, avoid discomfort.
You hit a nerve. Yes, we will. Do you call it therapy that your office is providing? Are they providing that support in terms of understanding what's going on behind the scenes? What's driving that person to use?
I think that during the assessment process, when we're talking about housing and we're talking about family and we're talking about trauma and all of the different moving pieces, we're looking at this person as a whole. And I'm very cautious about using the word therapy because there's a certain stigma, particularly in the community of communities of color around therapy. The immediate is, I'm not crazy. I don't need this, or there's all of these different negative connotations attached to the word therapy. What we do is provide support to meet people where they are and where they want to be as they move throughout their lives.
Thank you for highlighting that. I have people in my family who have had traumatic experiences with therapists. And this is like in the 80s, 90s, where I don't feel like maybe they were as progressive in terms of mental health as we are today. So it was a sense of like, you have a chemical imbalance. That was sort of like the diagnosis, right? And so that's AKA you are crazy, here, take some medication, mm-hmm. not really getting to the root causes of what was driving the behaviors to begin with. Mm-hmm. So yes, I can understand, especially in communities of color where that word is still seen as like a negative connotation.
And it also impacts people coming into treatment. So one of the key components of one of the moving pieces of why people may not seek out treatment at all, besides the abstinence space or being told that they have to stop, is lack of health insurance or coverage, stigma from family, neighbors, friends, and sometimes not being ready.
When you said not being ready, that was where I was going with it. So what causes someone to come in for help, right? Voluntary help. Mm-hmm. And then get to this place of a roadblock where they are not ready to receive the actual care and support that they need to reduce their harm?
I think for different people, it looks different ways. I think generally, most of us seek out help in a time of crisis. And the crisis doesn't have to be a level 10 crisis. It can be a level 5. It can be a level 4. And I'm just using that as a way to concisely put it. So let's say, for example, someone wakes up and they realize I have no more money and I don't know how I'm going to get my fix. And then they begin to feel the physiological symptoms of not having that fix. That might be like, you know what? I need to stop. I need to do something. I need to do something different. I can't keep doing this. And then knowing where a program is, having access to that program becomes key. And that's just one small example. But for different people, it means different things. It could be a family member who says, listen, I cannot deal with this anymore. You need to get help. So different people have different reasons why they may seek out treatment. And that doesn't mean just because they come through the door that they're going to stay in treatment. Because again, when we go to those uncomfortable places, when we're dealing with potentially trauma, when we're dealing with housing and all of the other things, it can become overwhelming. And the last thing we're thinking about is, you know what, I got to go to this group today. Or I have to go to see my counselor today. It might be, I need to deal with this concrete need first. And somehow treatment gets lost in that.
What is the tenure of treatment? Is there like a set timeline in which somebody comes in through the door and then they exit the program? Or is it very much to be like case by case?
It is a case by case basis. So we have people, depending on which program I'm talking about, we have folks who come fairly quickly through our program in a few months. We also have in our Park Avenue program, folks who've been here for years. We meet people where they are.
Right.
And when they leave our program, we hope that they're leaving having a better quality of life than when they came in. So whatever their goals are, we hope that we can help them achieve them as best we can. And we also offer continuing care. So we don't just say, okay, you're discharged, you can leave now. We also continue in care component where I like to call them booster sessions, where if someone is in need of assistance and wants to come back, or they need once a month for someone to check in, they can continue with our program as well.
Right. Is there anything that would like disqualify someone from being a part of the program? I know that you meet people where they are. I'm assuming there's more sense of trust there mm-hmm. where people are honest about what they're doing. But is there anything that would disbar someone from continuing care with Housing Works or the OASIS program?
I would say no, unless they decide that they don't want to continue with us. We don't not take people based upon their ability to pay, because the great thing about Housing Works is we're located in federally qualified health centers. So we can actually see people regardless of their ability to pay, whether they have insurance or not. So that's not an impediment or a barrier. I would say the biggest thing that might lead to someone potentially being discharged from the program if they don't want to leave is if they're bringing substances or alcohol on site, because they're putting other folks at risk.
That makes sense.
I did want to say that in recent years, harm reduction has exploded. OASIS, which is the state organization which manages our OASIS program and other OASIS programs throughout the city with their residential, inpatient, etc., has really embraced harm reduction in a way that has just gone leaps and bounds. Harm reduction has always been here. It's always been a part of the treatment complement. And there's been a few organizations like Housing Works that have always operated within a harm reduction model. But with the recent changes with OASIS, the state system, all programs are now embracing harm reduction.
I did not know that. All programs.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that's a good thing? Because I feel like the mission like has to align. Like you have to believe in something like this in order for it to work, mm-hmm. not for the state to mandate it to work, and therefore it does.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that. You're not saying that. But
oh, no. I mean, But it makes a lot of sense because, again, like most things, we have folks who talk about things. The actual practice and application is something very different. So when you think about Housing Works, because it's baked in and embedded into our mission, we are doing it, have been doing it, and will continue to do it. There are other organizations that are talking about harm reduction, but are really struggling with how to apply it. What does it look like? And so I think that there's a very clear difference. When we talk about, you know, one example that pops into my mind outside of harm reduction is when we talked about, I think it was a year ago or 2 years ago, the death of Mr. George Floyd.
Right.
And the number of companies and, you know, corporate entities that came out with diversity, inclusive statements, and all of these statements, and they were, you know, they were all online, et cetera. But then when you researched what these organizations or these corporations were actually doing, they weren't in line with that. Okay. With this amazing statement that they put out in connection to the murder of George Floyd. I don't mean to get controversial, but
no, that's great. I think that's a great analogy. Like, mm-hmm. you can talk the talk, but if you look under the hood, are your actions aligned with what you're saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think also another component of this is many of the schools now, social work schools, schools that are working in addictions, have now also begun to really understand that they need to teach students or teach folks who are coming into the profession, not just about the theory around harm reduction, the approach around harm reduction, but how do you apply it? Even in the tough cases where you see someone who is really harming themselves. And I like to use the analogy that you may see someone running to the wall. Our natural instinct is to block that person from running into that wall. We don't want them to get hurt. But self-determination, meeting people where they are, respecting their choices, is we may unfortunately have to stand to the side, watch them run into that wall, but be at that wall and say, how can I help you?
And that's hard. That's hard to do sometimes, mm-hmm. to be an onlooker and see people that you care about hurting themselves or harming themselves, mm-hmm. but recognizing that you can still help them through this process. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, has COVID exacerbated the rates of people coming into the office?
Yes. So it's very interesting what's happened in regard to the COVID-19 pandemic and what that looks like. So we saw an exponentially large increase in alcohol use. And we were in a opioid epidemic before the pandemic hit. But we saw an increase in use across the board. Now, we have an increase of use. We have folks who are in need of treatment. And then we have offices that are closed. We have spaces, you know, programs that are closed, services that are not available, or services switched over to virtual and they were providing telehealth. But that's under the assumption that people have access to computers, have access to phones, have access to the ability to connect to those services. So it was a perfect storm. So you saw this increase in alcohol use, increase in drug use, et cetera, decrease in access to services, and the services that were available, much of them were being given through telehealth, et cetera, with the expectation that people would have the ability to access the services. So we're still recovering from that because much of the services or services that are still being offered are still operating from a space of telehealth, because we continue to have, particularly in New York City, the continued COVID surges, et cetera. So it has been very challenging in some ways. But yes, COVID-19 hit folk who are struggling with addictions in a major way. And also add the policy component, because I know I'm going to controversy land, which I'm okay with. Think about the services when we had the initial shutdown. Can someone explain how liquor stores were deemed essential services?
Oh my gosh.
So we're talking about isolation. We're talking about the availability of a legal substance. We know it's legal, but we saw an increase in alcohol use. And the only socialization some folks were having was going to the liquor store. And people who may not have ordinarily drank or may have increased drinking is in a direct response to COVID-19 and the isolation and the fear and the trauma of it all.
Of course. I never thought about the essential stores component, how liquor stores were considered or deemed essential. I don't understand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you would see long lines and you're wondering, where are all these people coming from? And long lines in front of the liquor store, 9:30 in the morning.
A.M.?
9:30 in the morning a.m. You see folks lining up so that they could get in first.
See, I left New York March 2020 and went to Florida. So I think I was a little shielded from that. But since I've been back, came back last summer, and I see it. I see more of a homelessness population present. I see in broad daylight people engaging in intravenous drug usage. That's not something that I would see in broad daylight. I didn't know exactly if it was correlated to COVID, but that was my assumption, and it sounds like it was.
I think it is in some level. I think time will tell what that correlation looks like. I know that there are a number of research studies out there looking at COVID-19 and the impact of addictions, mental health, et cetera. I've read quite a few studies and research that is looking at what exactly is the impact, not only on adults, but also children in response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Of course. Children in general, or children of those suffering from addiction?
Both.
I can imagine. Wow, that's incredible. So just a couple more questions for you. Thank you so much, Dr. Blackwell. It sounds like through this harm reduction approach, you're meeting people where they are. So people are disclosing private information about things that they're doing, the drugs that they're using, the trauma that they're suffering from. Are they setting goals for themselves in terms of what they want to reduce or if they want to abstain? Is there a point in time when you feel like it's time to tell someone, okay, like, you're doing a good job with this, let's go beyond, let's see if we can move more towards abstinence, even if that's not their goal, if we can get them to a place where they're reducing the harm even more?
I think that we have to be very, very thoughtful and careful around that. Meeting clients where they are is indeed not just an ideology, it's a practice.
Right.
So while we may see a client who might benefit from an abstinence-based goal, unless they're ready to go there, we don't bring up that conversation. But
got it.
We do, during each session, whether it's in our group, individual sessions, talk about where they are right now. What would they like to do? Do they see something changing? And we do, throughout the treatment process, check in with folks. And we have folks who initially may come in, I want to use safer, but then change their mind and say, I want to go abstinence. One of the things is that we're very thoughtful around providing a very non-judgmental pathic environment. And so we have to be thoughtful about that intervention, what that looks like, and what the client is willing and ready to do. Because if we introduce abstinence too quickly, we may lose the client.
Right.
But we do the psychoeducation around harm reduction and let them know that their goal can change at any time, and we're ready to change our approach at any time.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. And then I guess my final question for you would be, what would you like people at home to understand about harm reduction? What stigma do you think needs to be deadened? We can deaden it right here and right now. What do you recommend for those suffering right now with addiction as well? That was like a three-part question. According to SAMHSA.gov, the U.S. is experiencing the most significant substance use and overdose epidemic it has ever faced. Exacerbated by the worldwide pandemic and driven by the proliferation of highly potent synthetic opioids containing primarily fentanyl and other analogs. Provisional data from CDC show that we have crossed the tragic milestone of a predicted 100,000 overdose deaths in 12 months from May 2020 to April 2021. This represents a nearly 29% increase compared to the same window of time the previous year. Harm reduction services save lives by being available and accessible in a manner that emphasizes the need for humility and compassion toward people who use drugs. Harm reduction plays a significant role in preventing drug-related deaths and offering access to healthcare, social services, and treatment. These services decrease overdose fatalities, acute life-threatening infections related to unsterile drug injection, and chronic diseases such as HIV and HCV. For more information, see show notes below.
I'm going to start with the stigma piece.
Yes, go for it.
I'm going to say for the community that we need to be very thoughtful around labeling, because any of us can be in a situation or respond to something in any way. And what I mean by that is that, do you have that extra glass of wine because you had a rough day at work?
Yes.
Okay. And then all of a sudden, when you think about it, it's like, wait a minute, I'm finishing off a whole bottle. Mm-hmm. It just happened that easily. And I think that when folks are in pain or they're in trouble, rather than judging and saying, you know what, you need to do something. hearing their narrative, hearing their story, and helping them along the process to figure out what that looks like is key. I think as a society, sometimes we're very quick to judge things, you're right, you're wrong, or judge people, you're right, you're wrong, this is right, this is wrong. Any of us can find ourselves in this situation where we're using a prescription drug one too many times, where we're taking that extra drink, where we're smoking cigarettes and know we have COPD because we need to forget about, and we can fill in the blanks about what that looks like. So that's one, the stigma. I like to use this statement, for the grace of God, it could be one of us.
That's beautiful.
So being very thoughtful around that, being very careful around, you know, not judging others, because it could be you, it could be somebody you know. That's one, around the stigma. Two, if you are suffering in silence, you don't have to. If you don't want to come into a program, that's your choice. That's okay. But is there somebody you can tap into? Can you tap into a friend? Can you tap into a community? If you don't want to come into a program as in NA, AA group, Gamblers Anonymous, any of those groups that you can go into and sit in silence. You don't have to necessarily say anything, but feel like you're not doing this alone, the whole concept of mutual aid. So if you're suffering in silence, please think about this. You don't have to do it. You don't have to suffer in silence. It's someone. Sometimes you have to look a little hard to find out who that someone is. If you don't want to walk into a program or pick up a phone,
Google.
But do that.
If you have access.
If you have access. And also SAMHSA has recently launched a line 988, which is a divergent from 911, 988, which is a 24/7 line for folks who want to talk about a variety of different things, whether they're thinking about harming themselves, whether they're engaged in substance use and they want to try and find help, etc. That's a 24/7 line. They don't know who you are. They just know that you're a person on the phone. So even if you don't have someone in your immediate area that you think that you can talk to, you can pick up that phone and call 988 to find access to someone who will just listen. Once you talk about something, once you bring it to the light, it has less ability to eat away at you, less ability to cause you harm. And that in itself is harm reduction, takes the power from it.
Dr. Blackwell, you really are just a wealth of knowledge, and I feel like you shared so much gems that people can really take a lot away from. I particularly love how you were sort of like, let's eradicate these labels and understand that we are all human. And in hearing from you, I can attest a little bit more to all the good stuff that I know happens from people I know that have gone through the program as well.
Absolutely.
So thank you for all of the work that you do. Mm-hmm. And thank you for destigmatizing a lot of the labels that we as a society have deemed as fit. And even in the recovery spaces, right? Like, some people turn their nose up to harm reduction because they feel like abstinence is the only way to go. Understanding that people are going to do what people are going to do. And sometimes you can't just wave a magic wand and say, I'm going to quit tomorrow.
Right. And harm reduction takes we take no stance. I'd like for folks to remember that. Harm reduction does not take a stance. Whether you want to stop, whether you want to engage in safer use, if you want to reduce, we are there with you.
I interviewed my cousin last week. She's a social worker, and I asked her, she works at a hospital. I asked her what she thought the most dangerous drug was. Do you have an opinion on that? Because she said alcohol, and I was actually surprised by that.
Actually, yes. I mean, yeah. Alcohol is one of the most dangerous, and I say that because of legality of it.
That's what I'm thinking. It's just, it's so legal. Mm-hmm. It's so...
Rite of passage. You become 21 years old, you can drink, but we've actually worked with folks who have drank much earlier than that. I think alcoholism is one that we need to watch.
Why are there no checks and balances? Like, I'm feeling a little under the weather, right? I went and bought Robitussin a couple days ago. They wanted my ID. They want to track how many times I'm buying Robitussin. Why is anyone tracking how many times I purchase alcohol in a given span?
Now you're getting ready to take me to another controversial place. I'm going to tie it to money. Who's making money off of it? Mm-hmm. Who's making money off of the use, and who's making money off of who's using? And we know disproportionately our communities, we can talk about the crack epidemic, the 80s, when we know that crack was being sent into our communities, and we can go on and on about what that looks like. So I think what becomes legal, what's illegal is based upon who's making money and who isn't.
Liquor stores being essential during the pandemic.
Yeah, how the heck did that happen?
That just blew my mind because I never really considered that until you said that.
Mm-hmm. And this is not just New York State. There were a number of states where the same thing happened.
definitely Florida where I was. Definitely Florida. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for touching on just so many relevant things that I think also will give people more to think about and potentially research. I will include in the show notes some of the resources that you mentioned.
And please, folks can also feel free to walk into either one of the spaces that I am in charge of and say my name and make an appointment. The Park Avenue location is located at 1751 Park Avenue, and the Brooklyn location is located at 2640 Pitkin Avenue. And we're open from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. And we accept walk-ins and or individuals who want to come in to receive substance abuse services.
Amazing. Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Blackwell.
You're welcome. Thank you.